Stunned silence.
What is this?
A bit of a side.
So it must be doing something. Right?
And it's playing its game or something.
Tell us what you mean.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Brilliant.
You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 115 for April 15, 2017. Gosh, those numbers get harder every time. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we're happy to welcome back Anna. How are you, Anna?
I'm really good, thank you, James. Good to be back.
Oh, it's great to have you. And it's also always great to have you, Don, the Don. How are you, mate?
Good, mate.
Good, mate. And it wouldn't be the 15th Station without Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. Happy Easter weekend to everybody.
Yes, almost at the Triduum.
We probably had an episode come out on Easter weekend before, but I can't quite remember one. But and what are we, 10 years? It must have happened before.
Nine and a half years. There's something for
you. Are you keeping dry?
Keeping dry, yeah. It's been a bit wet in the old Auckland of the last little while since our last podcast. We've had a couple of cyclones, another one apparently bearing down on us, and it's been a bit dramatic. You know, there's an apartment block just around the road from us that, you know, well, not just around the road, but in the neighborhood, that got, you know, the bank collapsed behind them and went smashing into it, and poor Edgecombe's got all flooded, and oh wow, yeah, we've had a real rough I don't know if you'd really call this weather autumn weather. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I don't think it doesn't fit into one of the four seasons. I think it's outside the normal pattern of climate.
Yeah.
It's like the climate's changing or something.
It's almost like. How are things over there in Sydney?
Pretty good. I'm enjoying a nice bout of late summer. Well, it's well into autumn, obviously, but late summer weather, so which is a nice change.
Lovely.
So we had a bit of rough weather for a while.
Brilliant. Good. And what about you there, Anna? Everything good with you are?
It is the last couple of days, but over the weekend we had a bit of a storm going on. But yeah. It's good.
It's been rough where we are. And then, Don, you've been travelling all around the world. Have you been trying to chase good weather, or have you just been doing what that work stuff?
Hard to do export stuff without travelling.
So. That's very true. I don't envy you for that. Well, we'll start off with some pretty sad news, really. This is not the best way to start, but it's pretty important news. This is from BBC. Two blasts targeting Coptic Christians in Egypt on Palm Sunday have killed at least 44 people, officials say. An explosion at St. George's Coptic Church in Tanta killed 27 people. Hours later, a blast outside St. Mark's Coptic Church in Alexandria left 17 dead. So-called Islamic State said it was behind the explosions, the latest in a series of attacks targeting the Christian minority in the country. President Abdul Fattah al-Sisi, is that how we agreed to pronounce it, ordered military deployments across Egypt. In a statement, he said the army would be sent to protect vital and important infrastructure. The government announced 3 days of mourning. In Alexandria, Pope Tawadros II, head of the Coptic Church, had been attending mass inside the church targeted, but was not hurt, state media reported. Several police officers, including one policewoman, were among those killed, the Interior Ministry said, and the suicide bomber blew himself up after they stopped him from entering the church. The first explosion in Tanta, which is 95 kilometres north of Cairo, took place near the altar of the church. It remains unclear if it was also caused by a suicide bomber. I saw pieces of body parts and broken seats. There was so much blood everywhere. Some people had half their bodies missing. Oh, the first three rows inside the church were destroyed. Abdul Nader, an eyewitness, said the explosion injured at least 71 people in Tanta and 35 others in Alexandria, the health ministry said. Gavin, it's just terrible, terrible news. And I think what's fascinating is the first I heard about it is reading it in the lineup. I just incredible persecution happening in Egypt. Just shocking, really.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens. This is obviously just a terrible incident, not the first, and unfortunately it probably won't be the last. But it's interesting that this comes, the week before Easter, so obviously a time when you know, time of great importance to we Christians around the world. And also Pope Francis is scheduled to go to Egypt in the not too distant future. So it'll be interesting to observe, I guess, one, whether it goes ahead, and two, if it does, what sort of response, I guess, he receives there in terms of a show of solidarity with our Christian brothers and sisters who are living in places where they are being persecuted and killed in many instances. It's, you know, it's fantastic for the Pope to go to Catholic countries and to celebrate with the faithful there. I think it would be a remarkable sign of courage, I guess, is probably the right word, for him to go to Egypt at a time like this and to show that sign of solidarity with our Christian brothers and sisters. So it will be fascinating to watch. I haven't seen anything in the day since the attack referencing the likely response of the Vatican in terms of the Pope's visit. So,
fresh off the presses, I did actually hear something about that, but I did actually hear coverage that he was still going to go ahead with the visit. There was a note in, there's a couple of things online at the moment saying that it looks like the trip's going to go ahead. But that's pretty crazy in terms of, I mean, it's fantastic that he's going in the sense of, you know, like you say, solidarity and talk about brave. But it's just tragic. I mean, Anna, when you get news like this, it really sort of brings home just how, you know, despite all the problems in this part of the world, from a sort of a, a liberalization of the culture, you know, it puts things in perspective, really, when you think about what Christians around the world are going through.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the Egyptian Christians have suffered for a long time, in fact, I think. Maybe there haven't been atrocities like this, but certainly for years they've really been sort of second-class citizens, and there's been I knew someone who was involved with the papal nuncio over there, and you know, even just building a church or something like that, like getting the permissions to do that from the government is a real mission over there, and this is just, yeah, horrible on top of all the difficulties they have suffered for a long time, I think. So it's very sad.
Don, what did you make of this? I mean, like I say, pretty tragic, obviously, but any sort of thoughts about what this means in terms of perspective for the rest of us around the world?
I guess I have two comments. The first one is that this doesn't seem to be getting nearly as much coverage as the Swedish attacks, where there's about 10 times more fatalities, and this is a direct attack on Christianity in a church, and ISIS has declared war on Christianity. So with that in mind, I think this should be dominating the mainstream news, and I'm kind of surprised, well, I'm not surprised, but really disappointed that it's not.
I did see something on Facebook, a friend of the show, Brendan, posted talking about a group of Coptic Christians gathering to chant the Nicene Creed in Arabic outside the church that was bombed. It's this massive crowd of people. And it's just incredible when you sort of see that kind of coverage, that kind of strength in just such dark, dark times. I just didn't see the mainstream coverage of it. But Gavin, I keep coming back to, and it is always hard, obviously, for us to sit here and try and piece together some semblance of logic out of what is just a totally irrational act. But this is persecution of a minority, and obviously these you know, incredibly deranged individuals and the whole of Islamic State, what do they think is going to happen? Have they not studied history? Have they not seen that actually when you persecute Christianity, all you do is make it stronger? I mean, it just seems foolish, and in addition to being incredibly wasteful and evil.
And we're sort of going to be talking about the clash of civilizations, I guess, in a story later in the show, about the response that comes, maybe not from something quite this direct, but the way that violence often begets violence. In this case, there's not the retaliation. We're not seeing Christians respond with acts of violence against people in Egypt. And we are seeing, again, it's very difficult because, you know, this is such a small portion of Muslims that are engaging in this persecution. And it's not just Muslims, other parts of the world, it's different religious or cultural or racial groups that are persecuting Christians or other minorities. But, you know, there were lots of stories that came out about Muslim people who were defending Christians and saving Christians. And, you know, the people who were stopping the suicide bomber were Muslim police officers. And so it's very easy for us to cast this into a true religious clash when really it's a clash of fanatical, radical, ideological people who it's almost impossible to have a rational discussion with. So,
although I think we really need to call Islam for what it is, and if you look at the history of Islam, a lot of the spread of Islam has been through violence. And if you look at some of the statistics that have come out recently, where Muslims in Western countries were polled as to whether they would report a terrorist, about a third actually said that they wouldn't report a would-be terrorist, which I found pretty appalling.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can look at the history of different religions and how it spread and find our own problems in most of them. I don't dispute, I haven't seen the poll you're referring to, Don, but I've seen enough polls in my lifetime to know to be skeptical about many of them in terms of methodology and selection, you know, bias and those sorts of things. So there has to be a serious discussion about what is driving fanatics, no matter where they come from. And at the moment, the reality is that many of the attacks, this appears to be more coordinated, but we look at what happened in the UK and in a lot of other places, these lone wolf attacks, which are becoming increasingly hard to try and combat. There's a much bigger phenomenon in play. And yeah, I mean, I'm not nowhere near smart enough to even start offering any thoughts on how we're going to fix this.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's move from one very difficult topic that is hard to be fixed to another very difficult topic that's hard to be fixed. So this is from Crux. After hours after the United States launched 59 missiles at a military base of the Syrian government, trying to block its ability to deliver chemical weapons, the Catholic Bishop of war-torn Aleppo denounced what he called the reckless action, claiming it opens new disturbing scenarios for all. The Pope and the Holy See are not heard, said Syrian Bishop George Abu Kazan, Vicar of Aleppo for Latin Rite Catholics, referring to the long-standing position from the Vatican against widening the Syrian conflict. There are those who want this dirty war to continue, Kazan said. The missiles were launched at the direction of President Donald Trump as a response to a massacre in the Syrian town of Idlib earlier that week, where an attack employing chemical weapons left over 80 civilians dead. The United States government is convinced that the attack was perpetrated by President Bashar al-Assad, although some observers disagree. One thing that baffles in the face of the U.S. military attack on Syrian territory is the speed with which it was decided and carried out, without any adequate investigation into the tragic massacre with chemical weapons, said Kazan. The prelate said he can picture Turkish President Recep, helping out Gavin.
Erdogan.
Not the way it looks like it's pronounced, rejoicing over the intervention, quote, decided and accomplished without taking any account of voices calling for an independent investigation into what happened in Idlib. Erdogan said, in fact, celebrate the attack, saying he welcomed the operation. However, he also said that it wasn't sufficient. Russia, on the other hand, a longtime ally of al-Assad, called for an urgent UN Security Council meeting, defining the attack on the Syrian base as reckless. From the beginning, Pope Francis has strongly opposed a foreign-led military action in Syria. Early in his pontificate, on the eve of what could have been a US-led invasion into the Middle Eastern nation, he called for a day of fasting and prayer for peace in the country. Well, who do I want to go to first for this one? Let's go to Anna. Let's see if you can give it. What's the answer to this problem in Syria? No, it's not to go with that. What did you make of the, I mean, in contrast to our previous story, obviously there was plenty of media coverage of these airstrikes. What was your kind of, what was your first reaction when you heard about these missiles being launched? Or for that matter, the chemical warfare itself?
Yeah, I mean, that is just terrible. Like, that's the chemical warfare. I mean, it's such a horrible way to be injured or killed, I suppose. And it doesn't discriminate. So it's, well, in fact, probably it's probably worse for children and old people, in fact, I imagine. But it's a real mess in Syria. And I guess there aren't easy answers, but bombing them is probably not going to be helpful. And I found that attack on the airbase or whatever it was that they were trying to bomb, it just seems a bit futile. And it seems like people in Syria are saying that wasn't helpful. And then there's the difficulties with other countries who have, I guess, a input in into what's happening in Syria as well, and putting them offside, like Russia and things like that. And it just makes it even more messy.
I think that's a great word for it, Anna. Messy, you know, a calamitous mess. There's been a number of articles, and I don't know if you've read any of them, Don, that have been talking about the fact that the Syrian war, you know, the conflict that has been extended in that environment, there are so many actors involved in the mix, and it's not just Syria and the states and Russia, it's also ISIS, and then there's the Kurdish rebels, and then there's the involvement of Turkey and the Islamic, the Arab states, and you kind of just look at this whole, this conflicted area, and it just seems like a mess.
Yes, well done to the Obama government and Hillary Clinton for their part in instigating the uprising, because that worked out real well.
Did they instigate the uprising? Do you mean the demonstrations?
I believe there was no spontaneous uprising against the Assad government, and there was no kind of Arab Spring, and that was perpetrated by the US at the time.
To what end? To what end? Oh, let's entertain the conspiracy theory, because there isn't evidence that they did. There isn't evidence that they didn't. But I've definitely heard this one. And I've also seen there's an article going around from an interview with a priest on the ground in Syria who's saying, you know...
Oh, yes, Brother Daniel, Father Daniel.
Father yes. Daniel, yeah. Before the demonstrations, the way he portrays it, everything was great in Syria. The only thing you couldn't speak out against was the political system, but you have, you know, they had freedom of religion and education was free and healthcare was free and everyone was living in a, you know, perfect harmony according to the...
It wasn't perfect harmony. And like, having visited these states, they're not perfect states, but they're actually pretty good places to visit. Initially, when I visited there, I had reservations. As a Christian and wanting to go to Mass on Sundays, I had reservations about talking to my hosts about going to these, even asking them to give me a lift to go to Mass. But I found these people to be incredibly hospitable. I didn't have any... I didn't feel that the animosity that's ravaging the kind of country now.
Right.
And I truly believe that it's as a result of the actions that were taken at that time.
So I think that's pretty much... so it's really... I mean, I've never been in the area, so I definitely can't comment it like you can from experience in terms of what Syria was like before this war. I think it's pretty universally agreed that the... sort of the beginning of this was the so-called Arab Spring, or the demonstrations against the government, and then the government, you know, responding, and then it kind of escalated from there, and then you had people who tried to start a rebellion, and you know, then that's how you get yourself a civil war, right?
And if you look at the media interviews with Hillary Clinton at the time as Secretary of State, she seemed pretty proud of herself, and she seemed to... implied that she had a hand in it. So,
what end? To what end? If that's true, why start a war in a country that is on the other side of the world?
I think she had great because they're not completely free countries, and they are run by dictators, and they don't have democratic systems. But what they have is something that works for their countries. And I think the US had grand ideas about the democratization of certain countries in the area, and it backfired completely.
Gavin, what do you make of all of this, of Don's commentary, but also just in general, what do you make of the situation?
I'll probably deal with the other Donald at the moment, the one in the US. It's interesting, there was, as you would expect and hope, such widespread condemnation of these chemical attacks that took place. I think there was a sense in which people felt there had to be some sort of retribution. I guess one of my observations has been, as you mentioned in the read in the story, James, some observers disagree with who perpetrated the attacks. As a journalist or former journalist or wannabe journalist, whatever I call myself these days, just observing that part of the story, trying to put aside the horror of what's happened. The first victim of war is the truth, or whatever, the first casualty of war is the truth. This sense in which there are people, some of whom are very intelligent people, who are saying that this wasn't al-Assad who was behind it. And they make reasonably credible cases for their view. Now, obviously, I have no idea whether he did it or not. There seemed to be in the first day or two absolutely no questioning of who was behind it. And in that case, it became a situation of, well, surely someone needs to respond. And then, as you would expect, when Donald Trump does anything, many people are going to love it and many people are going to hate it. So just looking at it through a news lens has been a fascinating sense. And it's, seems fairly inhumane to look at it that way rather than as a human suffering episode. But to me, this is just developing this is an ongoing development of really struggling to understand what is truth anymore, and therefore how one responds to, if al-Assad was behind it, does that justify it? If he wasn't behind it, then what's the discussion we're having or should be having?
It doesn't make a lot of sense that he was behind it, because he's winning the war, he's gaining ground against the rebellion, he's taken back from the major cities, so why would he risk a chemical attack and risk upsetting the international community at this time? It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, apparently there was some meeting that it was about to take place as well, so those are sort of the arguments that I've heard. And when you look at that, you think, you can easily mount a case as to why would he have done this. But there was no questioning of that by the media in the first day or two. And then President Trump responds in kind, basically saying, we can't put up with this nonsense, and strikes back, rightly or wrongly. You can make a strong case either way, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. It's just... so much of what happens in that part of the world is impossible to verify. And some people just don't want to sit by and do nothing while these atrocities are going on. And it's almost a case of, it doesn't matter who did it, we need to be seen to do something.
Sorry, go, Don.
And Trump may be sending a message to North Korea and Russia. So I've heard news reports that Syria wasn't even part of the end game, which I have issues with. So if Trump used Syria as a game card and a geopolitical game to send a message to Russia and North Korea, then that's pretty atrocious.
Look, I think, and I agree, absolutely. And I also think that if, I think your points are well made, Gavin, and Don, sorry, all your points are well made. But I think, Don, Gavin, your point that actually it's so hard to verify the truth and then to act regardless of it. I think the thing that was universal was the condemnation of the attack, of the chemical weapons attack. The thing that I always find, just as a little sidebar, but the thing I always find kind of interesting, and it would be interesting for your thoughts on this as well, like when we were talking about it and say, oh, you know what, the use of chemical weapons, and I like your point, you know, it actually, if discriminating, it discriminates at the youngest and the most innocent or the most helpless members of society. So chemical weapons, you know what, let's all agree that when we're slaughtering each other in war, let's not slaughter each other that way, okay? That's a little bit below the belt. Let's just go back to conventionally slaughtering each other. I mean, you see the shots of the coverage of what's been going on in Syria over the last few years and other conflicts around the world. And it's kind of like, is there any honor among thieves? Like, this is the thing that pushes us to the point where we go, oh, that's a step too far. But going and killing thousands of people using conventional warfare, that's okay?
Yeah, it is fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. Anna, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I thought actually chemical warfare is already sort of on the list of what not to do
in
a war. And that, like, that's a war crime.
Yes.
In fact,
isn't all war a crime, really? Like, even when we turn around and we say, and I'm not going to get into a big debate on just war doctrine and everything, but ultimately you're talking about, particularly when war is affecting unarmed, innocent civilians, you're talking about a crime. And any other time, if you weren't saying a war, it's murder.
Yes, and I think part of the problem maybe with war in the 21st century is that a lot of it's done sort of by distance, and so you're not there facing your opponent, so to speak. Yeah, and you know, we hear stories, say for instance from World War One and World War Two, where obviously there were lots of atrocities, but also at the same time, you know, on Christmas Day they stop fighting each other and they play a game of cricket or whatever they did, rugby or whatever. Yeah. You know, like there's a nobleness or something, if that's possible in war. But the way in which we engage in war, I think now, you lose the humanity and there's a lot more. Oh, maybe there isn't. I don't really know what the statistics are, but it does seem that it's not just soldiers fighting each other. So those who've chosen to go to war, and it's sort of everyone is at risk of, you know, like of being a casualty, I suppose.
And not to be a movie reviewer, but if those who might have seen Eye in the Sky, I think last year or the year before, a film about drone attacks, which was quite an interesting insight into what you're talking about, Anna, there, this idea that, you know, some people who are highly skilled engineers or, you know, people of that kind, IT people, are sitting in the desert in Nevada or somewhere, and they're engaged in bombing in Somalia or Ethiopia or wherever the film was set, I can't quite recall. That's part of what modern warfare looks like.
But I don't believe that they're deliberately targeting civilians, whereas ISIL is deliberately targeting civilians. So in defense of Assad, maybe he felt that he needed to stoop to their level.
Yeah, see, I mean, and I find that, and this is, great setup that Gavin gave me before in terms of segue, which I didn't take at the time. But ultimately, violence begets violence. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, that just ends with more pain, more bloodshed, and it just becomes a war of attrition to see who's the last person standing. What I find fascinating is, even if the instigation to the theory you're putting, Don, in terms of, you know, Hillary and Obama and all the rest of it, you've still got, at the end of the day, a civil war. And I was having to try and explain, you know, my son is at the stage now, you know, he's nearly 11. He's at the stage where he's studied war, like World War II and things like that. You try and actually explain to a little kid, and I was explaining to my 7-year-old daughter, because she was asking, because they were, you know, talking about Syria at school or praying for people who are in war-torn countries. You try and explaining a civil war, you know, that people who were neighbours have now taken up arms against each other. And this isn't what they're told. What they're told, you know, when they look at, they study war, like World War II and things like that, is, oh, there were baddies and there were goodies and there was evil and there was good. And, you know, it's all kind of black and white. And all the black and white is gone. And when you get into a civil war in particular, you start getting, it's almost like all society starts to break down. So what you would have thought was the common rules of decency and humanity just go out the window. To then have any foreign powers weighing in on that conflict isn't going to, I mean, the United Nations, my observation on the outside, has been totally ineffective in actually doing anything about this. And what can it do? You know, it's ironic that Russia now asks the Security Council to get together and have an emergency session. So what? So that the other side can start to veto whatever resolution they come back with? You know, the whole thing feels just futile and frustrating. And at the heart of it, it's the loss of innocent lives. You know, it feels like society or humanity is failing in this regard. And the devil's having a great time with it. Mm. And on that cheerful note, let's go a little more positive. I think we've got the dour negative stuff out of the way. The one thing I would say just before we move on is the one thing that we can do when things do feel helpless on this side of the world, there are some very practical things you can do in terms of helping out, like the Red Cross and organisations like that are looking for resources. And that's something that, if it's within your means to give, I think I would always encourage you to, especially in Lent, where we're called for almsgiving. The other thing that we can do is pray, because so much of this stuff is actually going to be beyond human means to solve. We need some divine inspiration. We need a divine kick up the jacksie, to be honest. So anytime that, if you wanted to pause the podcast right now and just say a prayer for all those involved in these kind of conflicts around the world and persecution, that they would listen to their conscience, listen to their heart, and be open to God, I think that would be a worthwhile spend of effort. I'm sure that's what the De La Salle brothers would be doing. This is from NZ Catholic. De La Salle brother Sir Patrick Lynch, that should actually be De La Salle Sir brother Patrick Lynch, looked on as Brother Lewis Harwood made his final vows as a brother of the Christian schools, or De La Salle brother, at St. Therese Church in Mangere East. It was a very touching moment for Sir Brother Patrick, who... Is it Sir Brother Patrick?
Yes.
Okay. Sir Brother Patrick, to witness this final profession, as it was the first for his religious congregation in 20 years in New Zealand and Australia. It's very encouraging for people like me. I've been a brother for 55 years, so honestly, this ceremony is just so uplifting. I haven't really experienced something like it for 30 years, he said. Which means that obviously the 10 years in between didn't go so well. A large number of students from De La Salle College, representatives of John Paul II College in Rotorua, and Francis Douglas Memorial College in New Plymouth, St. Therese parishioners, and Brother Lewis's family from Australia gathered to celebrate. Brother Lewis told those who were gathered he felt ready to take on the mission, quote, "But I need you in my life, your prayers and your support." He said that on his 30-day retreat, in preparation for the final vows, he spoke to a Carmelite nun who said her religious life, who started her religious life 58 years ago. She's seen all the changes and all the history, he said. She said, "The one thing you must learn, young Lewis, is that times get tough. Times get tough, focus on Christ. Brother Lewis promised, I'll do my best." What a good story this is, Don. What an uplifting palate cleanser after some of the previous ones. It's good to see the De La Salle brothers growing their numbers for the first time in 20 years.
Yep, absolutely fantastic. I don't think I can add anything else.
Gunner, this is just good news story. Gavin, you must have been you were excited about this. Have you got any connection to the De La Salle brothers?
No.
Oh, okay.
I went through a Maris Brothers school myself.
Maris Brothers.
I don't have a connection with them, so I'm not sure when the Maris Brothers had their last profession. It's an interesting story, so, I mean, I suspect there will be many orders like this, many of the orders in New Zealand and Australia and parts of most of the West. And, of course, we're seeing some orders, some newer orders that are booming, some orders, some older and more traditional orders, in certain parts of the world also booming. It was interesting reading the story in light of, as we've spoken about on the podcast, there's been this Royal Commission, this inquiry into the way the church and other institutions have handled child sexual abuse in Australia. Not well, you know, I guess is the general summation of how it's been.
Summary, yeah.
Yeah. But some of the people who were called to give evidence in the last couple of months, as the Catholic Church has particularly come under the spotlight, it has for the entirety of the inquiry, but they had what they called the Catholic wrap-up, and some people from religious orders were admitting that, you know, we're dying out, when we're not long for this world. Now, let's be honest, one brother doesn't change the historical trajectory of the De La Salle brothers, but it's important to recognise that the contribution religious orders have made in the life of the church, and that religious orders, long-standing, newly formed, will continue to have in the life of the church. So, yeah. So it was a glimmer of hope, I guess. And we often talk about the shortage of priests in the West, especially. Well, the reality is religious brothers and sisters are diminishing in numbers far more rapidly than priests are. So if we look at the role for religious orders and how that's being fulfilled, it's another part of the church that needs to look at how it evolves in through schools and through some of its other ministries and carrying on in most cases, the very worthy charisms that that were behind the founding of the orders in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It's a good point. Anna, what did you make of this? Good news that it is?
Well, of course, it's a great thing for the church and for the church as a whole when someone offers their life to God in a particular way and living it out in a particular way. And so my dad was educated by the De La Salle brothers, and, you know, they have contributed a lot to the church, and it's always a good thing, right? I think when someone gives their life in that way. So he's young, and it's great. Like, you know, it's good.
It's a universally positive story. It's
great.
That's great. let's go from there to building some walls, shall we? This is from the Associated Press. The Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Mexico said that Mexican companies expressing interest in working on a border wall in the United States are betraying their country. The Archdiocese said in an editorial that Mexican companies have expressed willingness to supply materials or work on the wall proposed by US President Donald Trump. Mexico opposes the wall. The editorial was titled Treason Against the Homeland. And said that what was most surprising is the timidity of the Mexican government's economic authorities, who have not moved firmly against these companies. In a meeting with steel companies in Mexico, Economy Secretary Ildefonso Guajardo, said that the government did not plan restrictions on businesses, but warned that Mexicans would judge and base future buying decisions on which brands are loyal to the national identity and which are not. Quote, I think your prestige will align with your own interests in not participating in the wall, Guajardo told the Guajardo told the companies. You've got to start doing some phonetic spelling, mate. 115 episodes. It is unclear how it's become a joke. It's unclear how many Mexican companies have expressed interest in the wall. The Archdiocese said Mexican companies have expressed interest in supplying cement, paint, lighting, and other materials. Any company that intends to invest in the fanatic Trump wall would be immoral, but above all, their owners and shareholders will be considered traitors to the homeland, the editorial said. Gavin, what if those people who are wanting to be traitors to the homeland are wanting to supply it so they can build in, you know, secret doors and you know, undermine the wall and have like concrete that actually collapses after a few. I don't know. What if that's their angle?
Yeah, you're stretching at this point.
What did you make of the story in terms of, do you think these people are traitors to their homeland, or are they just trying to make a buck in a time when it's hard to make a buck?
Well, I mean, that's the reality for some people, right? And I think it's right that they offer some pressure on companies. But I would say that the people who will be who would actually be doing the work, who are not the people who are sitting in the meeting with the economy secretary, Mr. Guajardo. Whatever his name is. So those aren't the people who are going to be building the wall or putting up the lights or painting the wall. There are people for whom, as you say, the economy around parts of the world is not great. And for some people, any wage is a good wage. So I don't think that there should be, I don't think there will be, but I think if Mexican companies or people from Mexico do indeed work on this, and I don't think the wall's a good idea. I don't think it's going to work, but anyway. But if a Mexican laborer goes and works on it, I don't think that person should be seen as a traitor. I suspect they're almost certainly somebody who's trying to put food on their family table, and their companies can be called into question, their stakeholders or their directors can be called into question. But I don't think people who are doing the actual work are people who should be persecuted over this.
Okay. Anna, what do you think? Do you think people who are wanting to get involved with building the wall are traitors to their country if they're Mexicans?
Well, I mean, Gavin actually brings up an interesting point, like, because, you know, there's companies that make those decisions, and then the workers are the ones who actually have to fulfill it. But they're often the ones that get the persecutions, maybe. Mm. So, yeah, I think there has to be... not that I want to tell the Archdiocese what to do, but you know, like you do have to be careful when you're kind of saying things that are quite strong like that, and maybe articulate them clearly, because some people might be caught between a rock and a hard place, you know, a matter of keeping their job or not. Perhaps some companies let you. Not work on that particular thing, like give you the sort of the freedom to do that. But a lot, I mean, you know, I wouldn't imagine that many would, but yeah, that's a difficulty. So yeah, I guess that's the Mexican bishops need to be careful about demonizing people, I think.
Yep, it's a good point. It's a good point when it's a complicated situation. It's not like the Archdiocese is saying all those people who get press ganged into doing this because you work for an organisation that's signed a multi-million-dollar contract, quit your jobs and we'll give you a job instead. Don, what do you think about this?
Oh, well, I'll throw some interesting statistics out there, and I don't think that the Vatican.
Oh, we always like your interesting statistics.
Has a the moral high ground and walls, because the Vatican is fairly walled in terms of its city. Yes, there's the opening part, you know, that leads up to the square, but there's lots of guards. It's pretty secure in terms of a city. Probably about 3,200 kilometres of a border. About a third of it is actually already walled, and that started in 94. So if you remember who was president in 94, that
Bill
was
Clinton.
Bill Clinton, yes, well done.
William.
So Jefferson he was president from 93. He instigated a program called Operation Gatekeeper, which basically put about, you know, through progressive governments, but it was started mainly in 93. So about a third of that border area is now walled under Operation Gatekeeper. And to quote Bill Clinton, he basically said, you know, we're a nation of immigrants, but we're also a nation of laws. So he did have issue with illegal immigrants. And if you look at the yearly statistics, they catch about 300,000 people a year, mainly from Mexico and Latin America, trying to cross the border. And they estimate probably about 600,000 or 700,000 actually make it across. Of course, with those numbers, because they're not official statistics, it's hard to get an accurate number. But if you've got 600,000 people coming across a border, into your country with no vetting, surely the United States has a moral obligation to their own country to secure that border, especially when we know that that is a major trafficking route for drugs. And we know that since 2013, there's been a 10% increase in drug use. So it's drugs have basically gotten to epidemic proportions in the US. It's growing at a rate of about 10% every 3 years. And surely the US has a moral right to defend itself in this instance.
So can I surmise from that that you would not call out Mexicans who would contribute to building the wall traitors?
Correct.
Okay, that's what I thought.
I just don't see the moral, and where was the moral outrage in 1994?
That's a good point.
So might they be traitors against Mexico, but not but supporters of the US and its border protection? Could they be both things?
Can you still be a Mexican patriot and not support people breaking the law?
Can you still be a Mexican patriot
and not... So can you still be a supporter of Mexico?
Yeah.
Because basically what they're trying to defend is illegal immigration, right?
Right.
And what I'm saying is that the US has a obligation to its own people and a moral right to defend itself against illegal, and let's emphasize the illegal immigration. So if you're a Mexican helping the US to build this wall, why are you necessarily doing something that's unpatriotic to Mexico?
Yeah, I hear you. I guess, and it's good, some good stats you bring up, and I mean, I didn't realize about the origination of the border as it's managed today. And of course, countries have the rights to enforce their borders, I guess, however which way they want. I would point out that, as you pointed out from history, there isn't a good history of walls being overly successful. I'm just going to throw that out there. There's even the newer ones. There's one that was relatively recently taken down in Germany, and that didn't do very well. And I mean, even the one that's up in Israel now, you know, you can talk about even the Great Wall of China or those walls around Rome. It didn't stop Rome being sacked. I mean, I just think walls as a construct are by default going to be bypassed.
So what do they really say? You know.
But then that's a different argument to this is immoral, to this is ineffective and crap use of funds.
Yeah, I think it's a good point that there is a difference between the two. It's a good point. And you're right, Gavin, build a 20-foot wall, someone builds a 21-foot ladder.
Boom.
Well, let's talk about our final story here. I wonder what Sam Butler has to make of all of this. Because Sam is at 44 years old. This is from stuff.co.nz. Sam Butler is one of the oldest altar boys in New Zealand. The Taranaki man is a well-known face at his St. Joseph's Waitara Parish, where his family have attended since 2000. While he is 30 years older than other altar servers among the flock, Sam, who turns 45 later this month, is showing no signs of hanging up his robe. Sam became an altar server in 2002 and has faithfully fulfilled his duties ever since. His mother, Moira Butler, said he really enjoyed being part of the church community. He just loves it, she said. He's a very, very spiritual young man. Duties an altar server performs includes carrying the cross and cradle into church. And candle, not cradle. Cradle. Gosh, it's too late. Candle into church before Mass begins and presenting the bread, wine, and water to the priest. Along with this help, Sam also offers a friendly face to parishioners when he greets them on Sunday morning and hands out the weekly newsletter. Moira said Sam's devotion to his faith included a collection of about 45 crosses, which he kept on a shelf above his bed. Stop there. That's good. What another lovely story to end. 44 years old. I tell you what, on my couple of years.
You missed the last paragraph.
Well, I can't see it. It just says the Butler family.
Oh, the Butler family are also part of a Faith and Light group.
Ah, which is a network of Christian communities for people with an intellectual disability. It helps if I scroll.
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 I can give you some IT help later if you like.
That'd be great. I'll stay back after class and you can give me some lessons. Isn't this nice? Isn't it a 44 years old, still likes being old server? 45, almost 45, is still robing up. That's good stuff.
He's got a cross for every year of his life, almost.
That's brilliant.
45 crosses. He's just turning 45. We need altar servers in our parishes. But we need people like this who, who just bring a vibrancy and a joy about their faith that, as I prepare to become someone whose age starts with a four, maybe I don't quite bring the vibrancy and the joy that Sam brings to church every Sunday, and maybe that should be a reminder to me that I should.
I think it's good stuff. What do you make of it, Anna? It's always good. Never too old to be an altar server.
Oh, absolutely. I kind of reckon that he's of the age not to be called an altar boy anymore, though.
Yeah, good point. Altar man.
Like a little bit. I mean, it's in the article, but an altar server or an acolyte, even, which would be.
Is that not a? Is that is acolyte? Isn't that an order? A proper order? No.
Well, it is, but you can be a sort of a temporary one, like an extraordinary minister of the Eucharist and things like that.
Okay. We're lucky we have experts on the show.
It is lucky we have experts on the show. Anna brings a whole lot of class and expertise. Speaking of class and expertise, what do you make of this, Don?
Well, if the water boy is still the water boy, then it can be the altar boy.
I think it's great stuff, and I feel my relatively paltry contribution for a couple of years when I was eight pales in comparison to Sam's contributions to the church and ministering for his faith. And good on you, Sam. So good on you, mate, and everyone else out there who serves beyond the normal parameters of altar servers. There's a few altar servers I've seen at the cathedral and parishes around here who are more mature, and I think that's
experienced.
Experienced. Thank you, Kevin. You know what? Anyone who wants to faithfully execute an important ministry, like helping a priest celebrate the source and summit of our faith, I'm all for. So good on you, Sam. And good on you all for checking out this podcast. If you want to go check out some of our previous episodes, you can find them at www.station15.co.nz, or you can go subscribe to us for free. You can do that from the website, or find us in iTunes under The 15th Station, and also Google Play, where other good podcasts are found. If you can't find us, just by the way, because we did get a note on that from, I forget, what was it, Stitcher, or was one of the others. If you're increasingly listening to us on different platforms, maybe we're currently coming to you through your TV speakers, and you're going, gosh, I wish I was able to subscribe to the podcast directly from my TV, send us a note to podcast@station15.co.nz. I'll see what I can do. Talking to Gavin, who's our tech support. That's pretty good. And if you just want to drop us a note and ask your hard IT questions to Gavin, I'm sure he'll want to answer as well. podcast@station15.co.nz. Being all techie, you can also reach Gavin and the rest of us at twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. I think that's everything on the old run sheet. I suppose it's just all there's left for me to do is wish you all a happy Easter. A happy Easter, Anna. I hope you have a great time in the next few days and the celebratory 50 days that follow.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for being on the podcast. You too, Don. Always a pleasure to talk to you, mate.
Kimber.
And Gavin, like I say, wouldn't be a 15th station without you, mate. Happy Easter.
Thank you, and same to you, and look forward to coming back to New Zealand and seeing you guys in couple of weeks.
Oh, yes, it'll be great. Looking forward to it. I don't think there'll be any Easter eggs left by that point. Hot cross buns, though. Oh, I managed to get a hot cross bun today. Pretty happy about that. I was pretty happy about
early.
That at work.
Oh,
yeah,
no.
I'm not sure if you're allowed them during Holy Week.
I'm pretty sure I actually had two. But that's okay, because I focus on the fact that they are the cross, and it took me a good opportunity to remind what the Holy Week is all about. And I'm sure wherever you are listening to this, you're very, very aware. Actually, by the time you listen to this, Holy Week will be done. So we hope that you had a good Good Friday, haha, and that your Easter Saturday is going well, and that you have a fantastic, blessed, and holy Easter Sunday and Easter season ahead. And until next time, take care, God bless, and happy Easter.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.